My name's Steve. I'm an alcoholic. And, really honored to be here and really humbled, honestly, to even be asked to be anywhere, let alone speaking in front of, 85,000 people. And it's really an honor. Congratulations to everybody that took cakes and tokens, and what a blessing. You know, that's such a gift. I mean, I can't even put that into words, what a gift that really is. I remember when I first got sober, and a guy looked at me and he said, think about how you feel right now, and I'm in Pathfinders, it's a disaster. And 145 pound ringing wet, and got the DTs, and I'm seeing things, got auditory hallucinations. I mean, it's like, it's not good. Obviously, it's not good. Wanted in a couple of different states for numerous infractions. And he goes, it's 1,000 times worse than you think it is. And I'm like, jeez. And I'm thinking, this is bad. So congratulations to everybody that took cakes and tokens. It's such a gift. And, my story is not really indifferent from anybody else's story, really. My family grew up in Kentucky. My father came to Kentucky, to Cincinnati, Ohio, to work as a tool and die maker at General Motors. He was from Boston, from Lynn, Massachusetts. That's in South Boston. And his father came from Ireland. So it's a really crazy ethnic weird thing going on there. And he was a really strict guy, very jet black hair, blue eyes, very handsome guy, had this really, really bad accent. And every time he opened his mouth, he seemed to get in trouble. And, I think he liked it, quite frankly. And so we grew up back there and bought a house and grew up. And I had two sisters and a brother. And it was really kind of a normal upbringing for the most part for the first couple of years. I mean, I can remember weird little things would happen in the house. And my dad was a really bad periodic alcoholic. And I didn't, I know what that is today, but I mean, who knows when you're 9 and 10 years old, who knows what's going on? And I remember one time, it's like Sunday morning, 10 o'clock, 9:30 in the morning, and I hear gunshots in the house. And, that's kind of a weird thing, I mean, it's just not normal. And so his bedroom door is cracked, and I'm like, I'm going to take a peek. And I look in there, and the guy's in boxer shorts with a high-powered rifle with a scope on it, with a bottle of gin sitting on the window sill, and he's shooting crows. We live in it's a residential area. It's not like out in the back 40 somewhere. There's houses everywhere. And I just scamper downstairs like, hey, it's not my deal. And I'm like out of the house, man, like right now before God knows what happens. And that's just one little thing that kind of gave me a little tip that our household was not really as normal as everybody else's. You know what I'm saying? And so, it's just these weird little things kept cropping up. I can remember there was a bunch of noise one night, in the kitchen, and it's like 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, well, somebody's breaking in the house, And I'm trying to wake Mike up. That's not happening. He's like, leave me alone. I'm like, I got to run downstairs, to find out what's going on. I'm like 10, what am I going to do? And I go down there, and my dad is drowning my mom in the sink. Seriously, he's got her head in the sink, and he's like drowning her, and she's like struggling, trying to get out. And when you see that kind of thing, you kind of just, you don't know what to think as a 9 or 10 or 11 year old kid. Something's just really not normal in this household, and it tends to start forming a character in you, actually, without you even knowing it. And I can remember another time I came down and he'd been drinking for weeks on end. And you don't really see, or a kid, you don't see any of the drinking and the weird stuff. You just kind of see some of the after effects. And he was in the kitchen and she did something. She bought some canned goods that he didn't approve of or whatever happened. And he took everything out of every cabinet, every loaf of bread, every can, opened everything, eggs, everything out of the refrigerator, and piled it all up in the kitchen floor just to get her attention. She came downstairs, and he promptly threw her in all of it. Now, when you see this kind of thing, it starts forming a character in you, and you don't really even know why that's even happening. What's going on in our household? Why is, you know, Jimmy's father not doing this stuff? And, you know, they're not shooting guns out the freaking window at, you know, 9:30 on Sunday morning. That kind of stuff isn't happening to them. So you start feeling these weird feelings all the time, and this little weird thing in your stomach is, you kind of have butterflies 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, because things are a little unpredictable. And that's kind of the environment that I grew up in. Now, he died of bronchitis pneumonia in 1971, which was brought on by chronic alcoholism. And we promptly shuffled off to California and came out here, and things just really kind of went from bad to worse, really. At least when he was there running from the cops and doing all the crazy things that he was involved in, we kind of knew how, you know, we had a house and we had a, you know, I was going to schools and things like that. But when all that ended, it's just like there was no supervision whatsoever, you know. Now, I'm this little kid with all this weird stuff in his head and with no supervision whatsoever now. Now it's like I can do whatever I want, whenever I want, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and nobody's going to say a word. They're just not. And, you know, my mom's drinking now, and it's a crazy environment. We're out to California, and on the way here, we stop in Las Vegas, and she's drinking constantly, and we're just running amok. She's just throwing money at us, and I must have been like 12 years old or something like that. And on the way to Vegas, I bought a lot of fireworks, and I mean, I bought a lot of fireworks. I had this thing about gunpowder and gasoline. And so I'm in this hotel room in Las Vegas with my little sister, and she's out partying, and they're all drinking and whatever. So I wire the entire room. I mean, I wired everything. And I remember when the rocket went off in the bathroom. This rocket was so big, man. It must have been this big around and about that tall. And I'm thinking, where can I put it? You know, what can I do with this? So I just put it in the bathtub. You know, and you know, I pulled the shower curtain and I lit this thing in the bathroom. The entire bathroom looked like a mortar went off in there. It was just a disaster. So after all that was all over, I flushed about six. I taped a bunch of, they weren't M80s. They're called cherry bombs. And these things, man, these things are nasty. So I taped like six of them together, and they got waterproof wicks. And I thought, well, I'm just going to flush these down the toilet. What's the worst that could happen? And I'm telling you, man, when those things went off down in that pipe, the whole room kind of shook a little bit. And then the water started coming up out of the toilet. The whole toilet was breached from the floor. I had no idea that kind of damage was going to occur, you know. But it was, you know, I'm 12 years old and no supervision whatsoever. And, you know, my mom comes stumbling in at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. You know, we're ready to go to California, and there's water everywhere, and nobody even gives a crap, and we just leave, man. Just leave. And just pull the shower curtain and go. Just, it's done. We're out of here. It's fucking California. The hell can we do out there? So we ended up in California, and I talked really, really funny. I mean, I had a really bad Southern accent, and I mean really bad. And so schools weren't a lot of fun. You know, you get made fun of, and things kind of go bad really, really quickly. And, you know, I'm sitting in the back of the class, and, you know, I wanted to answer questions, but every time I opened my mouth, it was just like people would start laughing, I would turn red, and then it was like, you know, chairs were being thrown, and you just don't do that out here in California, man. You might do that back in Kentucky somewhere, or back in a holler somewhere in Louisiana, but you don't toss chairs in California. You know, that's what they told me anyway. You know, he shouldn't have laughed, you know. Shouldn't have started laughing. And that just continued to happen and continued to happen. So school wasn't really a lot of fun. And so I came up with this bright idea that I would just, I would skip a couple of grades. And so I did that. And, you know, that was an interesting little scenario. But I forged a lot of documents. And, you know, at this point, I'm really a really skilled confidence man. I've never had a drink at this point, and yet I am really skilled at conning people, at lying, at manipulating situations, coming up with plans, forging documents. I mean, anything to get me where I want to go so I can do what I want to do was really just kind of came naturally. And that's just the way it was for, you know, for me really, really early on. And then at about 17 years old, you know, alcohol got introduced into the picture, and things got really interesting. I started drinking really, really heavy right away. There was no, like, romance period with this stuff. I can remember it was Pabst Blue Ribbon. We were at this, Mike was at this party. He was drunk. Here, drink this. And I drank 6 or 8 Pabst Blue Ribbons. I threw up so hard, man. That stuff was awful. And I threw up so hard, it was like Bob Wire. You know, is anybody throwing up that hard where it seems like somebody's pulling Bob Wire out of your throat? It was nasty. And I started drinking right away, immediately after that. Like it wasn't even a complication. I just continued to drink and continued to drink. And, you know, problems with the police and running into problems with these guys. I was heavily into motorcycles. I loved, you know, going fast and speeding and racing, all of that stuff. I had no supervision whatsoever. Nobody's told me what to do since I was 12 years old. I mean, keep that in mind. I'm just running amok in this city, and it's just insanity, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, nonstop. And now I'm drinking. And so I'm building motorcycles for people, and they're showing me different things to do to motorcycles. And I met this guy named John Todd, and John was he used to race flat track motorcycles, BSAs, and so we built me a motorcycle, and him and I would just run the streets all hours of the night, drunk and stoned constantly, and we would actually get the police to chase us for fun, and they would just chase us, and there we are running freaking. I mean, we would pull up, and I would flip a cop off, and it would be on, and they would just, like, you know, chasing us down North Park, all over North Park. It was crazy. And they were, you know, God love them, man. I mean, these guys are so stupid. I mean, John would go down one street, I'd go down another street. They'd be spinning circles in the middle of the street. They didn't know who was who or where was where, and it was the greatest time. And, I mean, I just felt invincible, really invincible. And we used to go down, it's a middle school called Wilson Middle School. It's in North Park. And at 7 o'clock in the morning, we would be drunk and stoned out of our mind. We'd take these motorcycles and go. And if you ever heard a flat-track motorcycle, it is really freaking loud. And these are big 500cc, you know, dirt bikes is what these things are. And We would push these motorcycles through a gate at Wilson Junior High School at 7 o'clock in the morning when they were doing assembly out there. And we would start flat tracking the field over and over and over until the police showed up. We wouldn't leave. We wanted them to be there. And they would show up and block off all these streets and block all this stuff off, and finally it was time to go. John would go one way, I'd go another way, and I'd push the motorcycle right through a gate that had a chain on it. It was just wide enough to get it out of there, and we were gone. I mean, we did that so many times, it was unbelievable. And never once even came close to getting caught. And I remember I was coming down University one afternoon, and I passed a cop, and I don't know whether he had been there one morning or hadn't been there one morning. He recognized me. He starts chasing me. It's like 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And I went flying down Polk Avenue and up this alley, and there was a cop right there. And he's got the whole alley blocked off, and they're, like, blocking me off. And I'm like, oh, my God. And there was a San Diego cop behind me, and I just sprayed his car with so many rocks. It was unbelievable. And that's when the cop at the alley pulled his gun and said, you know, this party's over. And the party was over. You know, the bike hit the ground. I went to jail. So we got caught and did about 3 or 4 days in jail and went to court and got a slap on the wrist and out of jail and off and running again, you know. So nothing really changed at all. And I kept drinking and creating wreckage like that for about another 6 or 8 years. I met this really beautiful girl, and I just fell apart, man. I fell so much in love with her. It was unbelievable. And I got, for the first time in my life, man, I got really scared. I'd never felt that way about anybody. And I said, you know, the thing to do is to move to Las Vegas. That's the thing to do. And so I packed everything up, man, race cars, everything I owned, 18, 19 years old, moved to Las Vegas with a friend of mine, got involved with some really crazy people, and literally these people were, when someone comes up to you and says, you know what, we had to get work permits. You can't work in Las Vegas unless you go down and get a work permit. Health permit, you have to have these little weird permits. So we go down there, there's a guy outside the work permit office, and he goes, you guys looking for work? I said, yeah, I'm looking for work, man, of course, I just got in town. He goes, well, why don't you come with me, I got some work for you guys. So we go down, we meet this guy, we go to this car lot that's closed, it's not open. I think it's in the middle of the week, man, why isn't the car lot open? And he goes, well, we only open when we want to. And I said, okay, whatever. You can sell some cars if you open. But it was like deserted. There was nobody there. You had all these cars and everything. And there was just one guy there. And he goes, well, what I want you guys to do is just start washing these cars. And we said, no problem. You know, what are you going to pay us? And blah, blah, blah. We got to find a place to live. He goes, I got a place for you to live. And so this guy gives us a house, gives us furniture, rent free. I mean, any car on the car lot we want to drive. And I find out a little bit later on that this guy's been involved in organized crime in Las Vegas for years. I mean, for years. And there we are, I mean, knee-deep in all of it. And we haven't even been in town like a week. And we're living in this guy's house. We're handing out his business cards. This guy's a known gangster in Las Vegas. I have no idea what I'm doing. We're constantly drunk 24 hours a day. And, you know, things just went from bad to worse constantly. I stole a car trailer and from San Diego to get my race car and all my stuff to Las Vegas. Well, pretty soon, man, after you don't bring the car trailer back, somebody's going to come looking for it. And so I had this bright idea, you know, I'll just dump it in Lake Mead. And who would find it there? So I take the car trailer out to Lake Mead, throw it in Lake Mead. Anybody ever seen Lake Mead? That's a big freaking lake, man. I mean, you can bury a lot of people out there. So I take the car trailer to Lake Mead, dump it in there, and about 2 weeks later, there's a San Diego detective in Las Vegas looking for Steve O'Meara, Grand Theft Auto. I never stole a car, man. I stuck a car trailer. It's the same thing, you idiot. It's, you know. And so I'm rustling together and tell everybody, you know, there's a cop here looking for me. And so I leave Las Vegas. Boom, get back to San Diego, go to the car trailer place, try to straighten all this mess out. Now I got detectives from Las Vegas Metro. They're in San Diego looking for me for some other stuff there. So it just goes from bad to worse constantly, trying to manage these the wreckage of drinking and living the wrong way. It's just piling up and piling up and piling up. And this girl, she comes to Las Vegas. I leave because, you know, I don't want to get hooked up like this. I don't want to get married, you know. And she comes to Vegas. So, you know, I leave Vegas, come back to San Diego, and things just go from bad to worse. They just keep getting really complicated. You start racking up DUIs. I had 27 drunken publics. I had DUIs that I didn't even know I had. I would get pulled over, and they would take me to jail for stuff I did I couldn't even remember. You know, you got failures to appear in this city. You got a failure to appear over here in this city. Do you know any? I don't know about any of this stuff, man. I don't know about any of it. And it was funny and it was sad all at the same time. You know, here's this kid that's 24 years old, and my life is a tragedy. It's just a tragedy. And I just keep on drinking, man. I don't slow down one bit, not even close. And me and this girl finally get, you know, to a point where, you know, I just got to marry her. I just cannot stand anymore. And this is a disaster. This is a unmitigated disaster. I'm a guy that I can't stay home for five minutes, you know. And here she is. This girl is like Phi Beta Kappa, 4.0, doesn't touch a drop of alcohol, is like straight-laced, like you can't believe. Now, what does that tell you about my con game? How do you make somebody believe that you're something you're not? Someone of that aptitude. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it was a complete con job. She's marrying somebody that's not even real. I'm not even real. You married the wrong guy, basically. And so she finds out, you know, oh, this guy drinks a little bit. I mean, he drinks a lot. He's drinking constantly, 24 hours a day. Don't you ever stop drinking? Not really, you know, I don't, ever. And it's almost like it's like she's a refugee, really, you know, seriously, and in a war zone, and there's no stopping, and she gets pregnant, and things just go from bad to worse, and I have no idea. I can't be a husband. I can't even be a person, let alone a husband, let alone a father. Are you out of your mind? And it's just, you know, she's getting big, I'm freaking out, I'm drinking more and more and more, and things are really getting bad. I set the apartment on fire like a couple of times. I've lost her car I don't know how many different times. You know, the poor girl can't even go to work. She's 6.5 months pregnant, and I'm setting the building on fire. You know, just trying to cook some tacos at 4:30 in the morning. And it just gets from bad to worse. And she's 9.5 months pregnant, and things are just really, really bad. And I can't stop drinking, and it's just insane. And I go out, and I don't come home for like 4 days, 5 days, something like that. And I do finally come home, and I'm in different clothes. I don't know where her car is again. And my sister's out there, and she, you know, Trish had the baby. I'm like, what? As if that was never going to happen. You know? She had the baby. I'm like, I'm stunned. We're going to be in there forever, man. I mean, really? She had the baby. I'm like, oh my God. I'm speechless. I don't even know what to say, you know? She's been in a hospital. It was a horrible labor. It was 27 hours. Couldn't have been worse. Of course it couldn't have been worse. You know, her mother-in-law has been there the whole time. I'm like, oh, shit. This is not good, man. And it's a disaster. That's about the worst thing that a man can do. is to not be there for that event. And it did something to me. For about a split second, I thought, maybe there's something wrong with the way I drink. Maybe that's got something to do with this drinking thing. Maybe I'm just a little bit out of control, just a little bit. And there was a guy in our family who'd been sober about 2 years, and he comes over to this burnt-out apartment, and he's like, Jesus, what's that smell, man? Well, the ceiling's been on fire, and the kitchen's obliterated, and I'm sitting there in shorts, and there's 4 or 5 trash cans out back. They're all full of beer cans, and I'm sitting in the middle of all this, you know, and he goes, you know, dude, I'm going to leave you this book, and you're going to die drunk if you don't do something about this. You understand? And he was there about 5 minutes. I kid you not, that was it. And I stared at that book. He left, and I stared at that book and stared at that book, and I thought, you know what? I'm really in trouble here. And it just kind of came over to me that I've got to make some phone calls here. And he said, if you'll call this number, they'll help you. He goes, that's the best I can do for you. Because people like you die of alcoholic deaths. That's what happens to you. He goes, and I don't want to be anywhere near this shit, ever. And I'm like, and he leaves, you know. The book. What am I going to do with the book? And so I called Detox, and I said, well, yeah, if you come down here, we might have this. You know what they say. We might have this. They don't ever give you a for sure answer on anything. We might have this. We might have that. I don't know. If you want to come down here and sit on 1111 Island Street and sit on the curb for 6 or 8 or 12 hours, we might come out and talk to you. Shit. Come on, man. So I packed up a little bag. Wasn't much worth anything in this place, and I went down to Detox, and I stayed there, and their 11-day program, I think it was 11-day program at the time, 7-day, 11-day, and I was there, and I was suffering from alcohol poisoning, delirium tremors, auditory hallucinations, couldn't eat, couldn't go to the bathroom, couldn't do a lot of things, and all I had was this little brown bag, and that was it. That was my whole life, 28 years in this little bag. That was it. And I went from there and, got some more information about these guys, about Pathfinders. And so I went there, and I stayed at Pathfinders, and I was there for 1 year and 5 days. And I needed every single second of it, every single second of it. I met a guy there named John Geiser who... he was actually laughing. When I first got there, they put me in upstairs in the jump bed. It's a closet now, I think, but it used to be called the jump bed. And they put people in this room because they knew they weren't going to stay. You know, I find this out later. They knew you weren't going to be around here very long. So they just, you know, why don't you just sleep in the hammock for a couple of days, and I'm sure we'll come up here and you won't be here anyway. So take some clothes, and, you know, if you disappear, nobody's really going to give a crap, you know, because you really weren't here anyway. That was the attitude. And so I stayed there, and I didn't go anywhere. And Gino was a cook there at the time, and I can remember going down to the kitchen, you know, for the first time, and Gino was a really thin little guy, and he started giving me crackers and honey. And he said, man, he goes, how long have you been here? And I said, 2 days. He goes, well, what the fuck have you been for 2 days? I said, upstairs in this room. And he goes, you got to get out of this room, dude. So he goes, I'm going to give you a chore. You know, there's a chore list, and you get these chores and stuff in this recovery home. And so Gino gave me this chore. I was going to wash the dishes in the morning. I was going to wash the dishes for lunch, and I was going to wash the dishes at night. And that was it. I was going to stay in the kitchen. Don't go out of this kitchen. Don't go anywhere. Okay? Don't do anything. Because you're not, like, all here at all. And so I stayed in there and shook and washed dishes for about 2 or 3 weeks, and it really wasn't getting a whole lot better. So he comes up with this bright idea. He goes, we need to redo this kitchen. I'm like, redo the kitchen. We're going to take all the cabinets all the doors off the cabinets, and I think we need to sand these things down. We need to re-varnish them and spruce this place up a little bit. What do you think? And I'm like, are you insane? So that's what we did. You know, that was my job. And I sat out back in the alley by the bathroom, and my hand shook so bad, and I had so much nervous energy, and I was so out of control. He knew exactly what to do, you know. And I would have never thought of that. I would have never thought of that. But so I sanded all the cabinets and re-varnished them all, put them all back on. And by that time, about a month and a half had passed. And I hear this guy. I'm at the 1 o'clock meeting, and I hear this guy cackling out there. And it was really unnerving. I mean, really. Seriously, I mean, the laughter was like killing me. It was just giving me such a freaking headache. And so he's out there cackling, and I'm like, you know, every 1 o'clock freaking meeting. And eventually, I just snapped. I just lost it. I went busting out that kitchen door, and I wanted to find out who was doing this laughing thing, you know, and tell him to shut shut up. Stop with the laughing, you know. And so I did. I came busting out that door, and there was this cowboy-like guy sitting in the freaking corner just cackling and laughing. And I told him, I said, you know, I don't know what's so effing funny, but you got to stop this, man. I got a headache that's like a bomb going off, and this is not helping. And his name was John Geiser, and he talked to me after the meeting and said, how long have you been here? He was very gracious and said, you know, you're probably gonna need a sponsor. And he kind of just volunteered, you know, out of the kindness of his heart to take me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And John was just a true gift from God, and he took me through the steps. And he said, you know, these things are really designed to do really quickly. And he goes, for a guy like you, you don't have a lot of time. And I'm like, you don't have a lot. He goes, you don't have a lot of time here to play around with this. He goes, guys like you end up drunk and they end up dead somewhere. He goes, that's what's going to happen to you. You understand what I'm saying? So as far as you're concerned, time is up. You are out of time. In fact, you're so far behind it isn't even funny. And we need to take the steps right now. You need to get on your knees. We'll take the first 3 steps right now. And you need to be writing an inventory in the next 5 minutes. Shit. I don't even know what an inventory is. What the fuck? Inventory? I haven't even read the... I don't know anything about anything. And he goes, don't worry about it. And so we got on our knees right there, man. Right then and there, you know. And went through the first 3 steps. I read the 3rd step prayer. He goes, can you read this paragraph? I said, that kind of insulted me a little bit. I said, I can read the paragraph. And he goes, we'll read the paragraph. And so I read the paragraph. He goes, all right, you got a chance. And do you think you can read that paragraph every single morning? And I said, yeah, I think I can read that paragraph every single morning. He goes, good. Turn to page 86. I thought, all right, man. 86, where's 86? I can't even find 86. And so, you know, I turn to page 86. He goes, look at the bottom of the page, the last paragraph, where it says upon awakening. He goes, you know what that means? And again, I felt a little insulted. I said, well, what do you mean, upon awakening? He goes, what it means is when your eyes open. That's what that means. And he goes, when your eyes open, you need to read this paragraph, all of it. And there are 4 specific things on that paragraph that you, in particular, need a lot of help with every single day from God. And I'm like, fuck, man. And I got this thing with God. You know, at the time, I'm thinking, you know, he's never done me any favors. I don't want any favors from him. It was a good relationship. I don't want to screw this up. And he goes, understand this. We're going to talk about God a lot, okay? I don't care what you think, and I don't care what you feel. He goes, you got alcoholism. So what you think and what you feel is the least most important thing going on here. read the paragraph. And that was John, you know, so I read the paragraph. And there's four things, he was right, there's four specific things right on that page. And I started getting it a little bit. He goes, you need to do that every single day, every single day. And he goes, by doing that, what's going to happen is your thinking is going to evolve a little bit. Not a lot, but just a little bit. And hopefully, it might be sufficient enough to keep you alive for the next couple of days. And so I started reading that stuff, and I started getting into the book, and I started, you know, writing that inventory, and I read the inventory off to him, and did my fifth step, and the sixth step, and seventh step, and he goes, now you got to make this amends list, and I'm like, oh shit. And so I wrote the amends list, and he goes, now if you need some help with any of these things, he goes, you call me, and let me know how it's going. And that was really it, man. That was it. And from then on, I've been doing that stuff since then, you know, since 1987. And I got a great life, man, I'll tell you. I mean, I got an incredible, incredible life. The Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous has just been incredible to our family. To me in particular, I lost a daughter 3.5 years ago in a drunk driving accident. And I can tell you that when I came out on the porch that day and found that business card from the medical examiner on my porch and then found out, you know, subsequently what happened, my entire world just exploded. And I mean exploded. And I've been sober a long, long time. And I never dreamed anything like that could ever happen, ever. You know, she's 22 years old, and I got this card in my hand, and my heart just exploded, like somebody shoved a stick of dynamite in my chest. Everything in my world just disappeared like that, in a tenth of a second. And never were those phone numbers in my wallet so important. Never. And the reason I tell you that is that if personal tragedy and heartache and setbacks have not come to you yet, be patient. They're on the way. And never will those phone numbers be so important than that moment. And as I was on my knees in that driveway, fumbling through that wallet, throwing phone numbers one after the other, one after the other, one after the other on the hood of my truck, trying to dial those phone numbers as I was literally just dying. And people were, you know, on the phone, you know, we'll be right there, we'll be right there, hang on, we'll be right there. And the driveway in 10 minutes had so many cars in the driveway, it was unbelievable. It was like a parking lot at Kmart. And all these people were from Alcoholics Anonymous. All of them. I had people staying at my house for weeks. Literally moved in. And Alcoholics Anonymous, the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, is second to none, period, to any organization that there has ever been. And I think about, like, I think back what John did out of the kindness of his heart. He didn't know me, man. He didn't have to help me. But here was a guy who'd been sober a long time, you know, had everything, took time out of his day to take me through Alcoholics Anonymous, take me through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, show me how to take the steps, emphasizing what's important, what's not important. And it was just an incredible, incredible journey. And I can tell you today that there was a time 3.5, 4 years ago that I thought I would never have joy in my life ever again. I didn't think I would ever laugh again. I didn't think I would ever... I thought our family was just going to explode and blow apart, as most times that's what happens when things like that happen. The family doesn't stay together because it's just so painful. And that's not been the case with us. I wonder why that is. the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God has poured into our hearts from that very moment. And the more you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, the more you reach out and help people, you know, that's what happens to you. The love of a loving God will pour into your heart, and you'll never be the same again. You just won't. And I am really, really grateful to be sober today. Believe me, I am grateful to be breathing. My family is grateful beyond words. And I am so humbled to be here to share my life with you guys. My journey from back when I was a little kid to all the weird things that have happened to where we are now. I went to, we took a trip, I'll end with this, and because it had such an impact on me. It had been a while, 2.5, 3 years, and since we lost Becky, and my wife says, you know, we go on a vacation. And I'm like, man, wow, where are we going to go? You know, she goes, well, I think we got to go to Ireland. I'm like, what? And I didn't know. I didn't even know if I heard her right. You know, I think we should go to Ireland. And I'm like, okay, let's go to Ireland. And you know, you don't like to ask a lot of questions about that. It's just like, okay, you know, so we go. So we plan this big trip. We're going to go to Boston first, and we're going to go to Ireland, and then we're going to go to New York City, and then we're going to come back to San Diego. It's like 14 days. And so we plan all this out. The whole family's going, my wife, my other daughter, my son, and we actually do it. We actually do it, man. We booked the plane fares, went to the travel agency, booked all these plane fares. It was freaking so confusing. It was unbelievable. And I'm like, I don't even say a word. I'm like, whatever. You know, I'm really just along for the ride. Seriously. And so we go to Boston for 4 days. It was awesome. It was just an awesome, awesome thing. That's an incredible town. And we get to Ireland, and we'd been there for about 2 days. And I get up one morning, and I'm in Dublin, Ireland. We'd seen all these fantastic castles. It was just a dream vacation. Do you understand what I'm saying? It's unbelievable. And exactly what we needed, you know, to be there as a family. And I get up. It's like 6 o'clock in the morning. I go down to the lobby, and I thought to myself, what am I going to do? These guys are asleep, and everybody's exhausted. And I thought, you know what? I'm going to go running. I'm just going to go run. So I went back upstairs and put some sweatpants on and grabbed my gym shoes. And I thought, I'm going to go run right now. And there I was in Dublin, Ireland, 6:30 in the morning after eating a light breakfast. I'm running in Ireland. And it dawns on me, I'm a free man. It just hit me. I'm free, man. I'm 100% free. Because only a free man could be doing that. It just like that. I'm free from all of that, you know. And we enjoyed the rest of the vacation. And it was amazing, amazing, amazing trip. And those are the kind of things that will happen to you. Maybe not those things specifically, but things exactly like that, you know. The blessings are unbelievable. So if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, keep coming back. If you're old in Alcoholics Anonymous, keep coming back. I really appreciate being here. Thank you so much. My heart is just really, I'm just so humbled. Thank you so much.